Art Garfunkel has been singing since he was a child. His voice and his image are now an indelible part of American music. He'll be visiting Tucson on January 16th, presenting an evening of standards and Simon and Garfunkel classics with the Tucson Symphony Orchestra. When I got the chance to talk with Art Garfunkel, I wanted to tell him how I first became aware of him. He was standing on a darkened stage, singing I Only Have Eyes for You on the second episode of Saturday Night Live. I wanted to know what draws him to songs like that, and what was on his mind as he was beginning a musical career separate from what he had achieved with his partner, Paul Simon.
I connect to melodies more than lyrics. Things I record have to do with what's kicking around my head these days, and so you do what comes natural lately. But my influences are all over the place through the years. You'd have to name each individual thing. I Only Have Eyes for You came from the Richard Perry Breakaway album. Richard and I wanted a show that the elegant love songs of the Jerome Kern, Richard Rodgers, Harold Arlen era, when added to a rock groove, becomes a beautiful marriage. They used to be performed in swing time or with a big band or bass, drum, guitar, piano standard format. But if you take what we know in our rock and roll age about danceability and grooves and make the electric piano very sustain-y and make the guitar be an electric guitar, then the whole thing has groove, and that's what I Only Have Eyes for You was.
And is that the kind of material you'll be singing with the Tucson Symphony?
I'm going to do half my songs in my set with symphony, half without. I haven't made up the set list yet, but I believe I'll do what I've been doing lately, which I find great fun, to go through my career now that it's five decades old and to revisit a gem from this album and that quite strictly backwards. So I'll go through the years, and the first song will be from that Richard Perry Some Enchanted Evening album. I'll start the night from the present and work my way back.
Your public persona and the timing of your projects kind of gives the impression that you're a very patient person. Does patience come easily to you?
That's interesting. You're reading patience where I read a certain, I think the word is luck. I'm lucky enough in show business to have my cake and eat it and to do things on my own terms. The things I want to do because there's an art quotient in it, and it's not just a moneymaker. And to wait and do them slowly with respect for playtime and vacation and rest time and raising a family in between projects. I'm a philosophical guy trying to live a balanced life where work doesn't consume me, but it does when the project is on. It does consume me. So patience is a word for the fact that I've been lucky enough to control my schedule through the years. When I made a movie called Carnal Knowledge, because Mike Nichols conceived of the notion that I could be a starring actor, and I took a deep breath and took my best shot, and then got nice reviews standing up alongside Jack Nicholson and Anne Margaret, and I felt good that, gee, maybe I can act. Scripts would come to me, like Slaughterhouse-Five, and I would say no to everything.
Oh, wow. I never knew that. That is a great detail.
Yeah, it's a good script.
Yeah, it was a great movie, George Roy Hill.
But I was very standoffish in these days, and I would say no unless it was right in my wheelhouse. Mike Nichols sent me, he was about to do a Broadway musical, Annie. He wanted me to be the singer with this new song the world had never heard of. The sun will come out tomorrow. But when it got to Bet Your Bottom Dollar, I said, no, I come out of the Bob Dylan age of hip. We singers can't sing Bet Your Bottom Dollar. It's too Broadway. It's too wholesome. And like a fool pursuing imagery, I passed on a song that went into the world's repertoire of well-known, loved songs.
Well, do you still get a lot of scripts sent to you?
Not a lot.
Your most recent appearance that I'm aware of was on the HBO series Flight of the Conchords.
I went out to Brooklyn and did a thing.
Were you familiar with them before they offered you the role?
Frankly, no, not really.
Did you see any of their work afterwards?
I did.
And did you see reflections of your own history in the acoustic duo with their ups and downs sometimes?
I know that they're kind of schlemiels in New York, and that their manager is very funny in his ineptitude. He's the grade D-minus manager. I've been there. I had such a such an experience. I've scuffled. When I met the lads out in Brooklyn to shoot that night, I approached them as two guys who were in a famous duo, and the dynamics, personality-wise, and in terms of the maturity to carry on year after year with your buddy and keep cool is the name of the game. So I approached them as they would expect, with a kind of knowingness of duo, of dynamics in a duo. But they were pros. They were sweethearts. New Zealand people. They're lovely. They love deadpan like I do. I have riffed all my life with my friend Paul Simon and those who have my sense of humor on things that you say that are off the wall but with a completely straight deadpan look. And that's very much my humor. And so these guys are fellow travelers.
And the humor that you're talking about that you and Paul Simon share is something that was always evident when you appeared, to bring up Saturday Night Live again, like the time that you hosted. You guys got a chance to do that on a public stage, and I think people found out how funny Simon and Garfunkel were, not realizing you guys were capable of laughing at yourself and at the world like that.
We come from junior high school together. We were buddies in our earliest years when we were developing a personality and making up our clothes, our hair comb, our pompadour, our nickname, and our style. So we know each other from before all of that was made up. That's a deep old friendship. The implication is always, you can't fool me. I know who you were before you became the person the world knows, before you even recognized yourself. Yeah, the Simon and Garfunkel are known for singing well together, but our laughing and sense of humor is the true core of the group always. We've been laughing at inside things from Lenny Bruce to Mel Brooks all our lives. We put a bit on one of our records. I said, let's be Nichols and Maypole. You be in the control room. I'll go out on mic, and I'll be terribly, profoundly serious about how disturbed I am that people don't take the breakup of Simon and Garfunkel with proper seriousness. So I'm very pseudo-profound. Maybe you heard this recording. It's on one of our albums. And Paul's in the control room and constantly interrupting me. It's just a screwing around bit we did. If you saw the Saturday Night Live bit, it's built around Paul waiting online for the movies and running into all these old friends and fans. And he has this remarkable memory for everybody who runs into him, even though he's the famous Paul Simon. He knows the person who was at his concert in Minneapolis 30 years ago in the third row. Now Art Garfunkel comes by, and Paul goes, you are, and that's the bit.
The face was familiar, but the name escaped him.
That's right. Well, I know you from somewhere. Paul, it's me, Artie. I didn't feel like working with Paul that night, and Lauren Michaels called me and put Paul on the phone. He said, you got to come down, listen to the bit we have. It's so funny. And when they gave me the bit, I laughed, and I said, you know, good material trumps everything.
You know, when we go back to talking about the earliest days where you're playing coffee houses and you're playing these little gigs around New York.
Greenwich Village.
Hard work for low pay.
The Gaslight.
What kept you coming back? What was it about being on stage and singing those songs that you just knew it was the right choice for you to be there?
Paul kept me coming back. If it weren't for that driven partner of mine, I would have gone on to college and been a little more of a middle-class guy who knew he could sing but was not determined to have a career in the music business. It was Paul. Now the truth is out. The driven one. We had a manager just before we got famous, a year before. We had signed to Columbia Records and made an album that went nowhere. So the manager, Marvin, decided we should dress up in black suits, be more proper, wholesome, clean cut, short hair. We had black suits. We had red and black rep ties. We were Ivy Leaguers, and we sang in the Gaslight. in the village. It was a very popular Greenwich Village coffee house that you sang in. It had 65 people in it. The night we played, it had 9 people in it, and the two girls in the front seat, as we began our first song, buried their heads in their arms over how pathetic they thought we were. And we were kind of pathetic. We were singing a song. It was a troubadour's Renaissance song, and I had a medieval scroll. I mean, we had everything but the tights. And it was a comedy song, but we did not really have enough savoir-faire on stage to pull off any comedy Renaissance song, and it was just stilted and collegiate in the worst sense. And these are the dues-paying years. Pain. I did a show at the Sunnyside Gardens in Queens years before this when I was a little pisher. Teenager.
Wait, pisher?
P-I-S-C-H-E-R, the Jewish word for a little no-count. Well, we were out in Queens. Paul Simon and I had a booking. We were Tom and Jerry. We needed to go to Sunnyside Gardens and play a 3,000-seater right near the Triborough Bridge. Tough neighborhood. Somehow Paul found out before I did that attendance was not 50%. It wasn't 20%. It was 2%. He found out before I did, and he was sick that night, and I didn't know it, but I faced the house with its 3,000 seats and the first row and a quarter filled with people. And proceeded to do my best. Hey, school girl in the second row, and did the show.
And you meant it.
These are dues-paying days.
Were you and Paul dissatisfied with Wednesday morning 3 a.m., or were you just dissatisfied with the reaction to it?
Interesting question. More the first. Considering that I was pleased with our blend and very on to my friend Paul Simon's commercial, beautiful writing gift, because there was the Sound of Silence already, and there was about 6 or 7 gems of early Paul Simon songs in that first Wednesday morning album, mixed with cornier, more traditional folk fare, things that the Chad Mitchell Trio would have done. You can tell the world about this. That's middle of the road, and it's nothing that special coming out of our voices. But the other stuff was special. And I don't know. I think when I finished the album, I felt the world may easily miss what we're really about. This album is a little bit compromised and made by committee in a corporation to have some safe folk songs. Exciting New Sounds in the Folk Tradition, it was subtitled. So, you know, I was learning to be an artist by committee, which is a funny kind of a compromised artist.
When things changed and you guys made the commitment to go back into the studio, how did that feel? I mean, did you...
Forced.
Yeah, I was going to say...
Like, life leads feelings. Feelings don't lead life. Events and circumstances happen, and when they're very compelling, like Boys, whether you like it or not, you're heading to be number one on the American charts. You get with the program, but our emotions were elsewhere. Paul was thrilled to be outside America, and he had fallen in love with Kathy Chitty, C-H-I-T-T-Y. He lived in Knightsbridge, and he was the great expatriate American with all this elbow room. He had dropped out of Brooklyn Law School and gave up university for good. He already had a college degree from Queens. And I was thinking, we made a folk album. It didn't happen. So be it. My real life is still in the process of making itself. Now, what will my profession be? And I was trying to be an architect in those days. But pop music seemed like an avocation, not my life. So when you have the number one record and Paul comes home, and I could see he doesn't want to come home. You just have to relate to the success. We met up in Paul's basement. We said, all right, we've been given this thing we strove for years, the world's attention. We can't drop it now. Let's surprise them with a follow-up record to The Sounds of Silence that's got chart muscle of a completely different musical nature. So we'll show them that we don't have to copy ourselves. And we made Homeward Bound.
And the rest was history.
And dun, yes, dun, it was. Dun. And then the 60s was history. Then the 70s and 80s and 90s is revisionist history. when you erase some of the truths and you put spin on some of the others. The one about how Paul Simon was pissed off that Artie rejected Bridge Over Troubled Water. I saw that fiction get born way back in the late 70s when Bridge was only 8 years behind us. And then it got repeated and requoted in the press. Then there was a period when I tried to stamp it out and say, none of that is true. Here's what happened. And it still didn't correct it. It just became this myth. History is a funny word. It's full of people. Who's doing the history? Who's recording with what in mind?
Do you generally feel that you've been portrayed well in the media over the years, like in the 70s and 80s?
No. I think the media is a distortion. It's tough to relax enough to show who you are. Strangers may say, oh, no, we know you very well, Arthur. We got you. You'd be surprised how the camera reveals. But I don't know. I keep thinking when I meet somebody that they're going, I have no idea from the media that this is your nature. I think when the recording button is on, reality changes. So therefore, we never can get the truth of things across through any recording device.
Well, that's an interesting notion to say on tape.
Yeah.
It creates a whole other level.
Well, I'm giving you my projected. You don't see my temper right now.
No. And well, as I said, your public persona to me was someone of patience and coolness. I always think of the pictures of you where you're sitting on an amp or on a crate, and you just have this weight. You know, you're in this weight. You're waiting for the musicians to get tuned up. You're waiting for the band to get ready. Waiting
that's
for
right.
the sound check to get done.
That's the artist life. You're a package of passionate. You're tuned as a being, and there's always the next piece of business, the next take you're going to record, or the next run through. So you're containing all that energy and all that caring. You care desperately that you put your best sound into the mix with your mates. So the caring is extreme, and you lose a lot of weight this way. Inside, you're burning up your food. The metabolism is running along quite fast, but the outer appearance, mine, is quite the opposite. It's still, while you're basically listening, hearing the music, you know, hearing when the moment is right. I was a partner for many years. I'm very clued into the rhythm of my partner and where are we at and what's when do we go back to the mic. And so, like a hand-in-glove ensemble player, I contain the energy and I reveal very little.
How do you take care of your voice?
Stay out of trouble. Don't become a student of any teacher or doctor, because words are cheap and that'll confuse you. Stick to the simple truth that my nature, as I know me, my parents' son, is a nice guy, and that my singing gift is a sweet thing from the angels. Leave it alone. Preserve it. Don't cast pearls to swine. Don't sing too loud. Don't drink Southern Comfort. Don't scream. Watch out for the phone. Don't get embroiled in a pragmatic issue on the day of a show. That's how I take care of my voice. Get a great night's sleep. Try and get at least 8 hours before a show. And warm up during the day. Sing easy in the mid-afternoon, and sing more from low to mid to higher notes as it gets closer to showtime.
Art Garfunkel and the Tucson Symphony Orchestra will be performing at the Tucson Music Hall on Saturday evening, January 16th.